It is Saturday, January 17th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Week in Geek News, and a discussion about Photoshop CS4, which has been out for a while. We have a product manager, Brian O'Neill Hughes, and he's going to be joining us to talk all about the new features with this, of course, kind of default, de facto photo management tool, Photoshop CS4.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on the program, we're going to be talking about Photoshop CS4, all the features and benefits and all of that, and talking kind of in-depthly, hopefully, about some of the new technologies that are in there. They're kind of exciting. And during the second half of the show, we'll welcome you to join the conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800, again, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll give it that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Tomorrow, KSP brings you to two special programs covering the inauguration of Barack Obama. Tune in at 10 a.m. for stories of the new president on This American Life with Ira Glass. Then at 11, stay with us for We Are One, the Obama inaugural celebration at the Lincoln Memorial. It's a three-hour live concert from the National Mall with an all-star lineup including Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Wonder, and Herbie Hancock. Special inauguration coverage begins Sunday morning at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have geeks. Alan Lucklow, he's a new media architect. Alan, morning.
Morning, and by the way, it's Luckow.
Thank you very much. I did that all last week, and I'm so sorry
it's okay.
About that.
It was funny. Yeah.
Wow. I now own, got a name wrong. That's a first.
You know what, though? I now own Lucklow.com.
So can we just change your name?
Oh, you got it.
Yeah, I did. Why can't we just change your name then, Al?
Well, maybe. I don't know.
Alan Luckow, and he does have Luckow.com. We also have Ben Jaffe, freelance media dude.
Good morning, Ben. Everyone.
Did I get you right? Because I'm talking about you for years.
Actually, so. It's Jay Faw.
Miles Elam, student, programmer, and political junkie.
Good morning.
And our guest, of course, today is Brian O'Heal Hughes, and he works for Adobe. He knows a lot about Lightroom, too, but, of course, his focus is Photoshop CS4, which we'll be talking about after the Geek News. Thanks for being here, Brian.
Thank you. I think that was O'Heal, which is perfect for Photoshop, but it is O'Neill. Yeah.
O'Neill, okay. My name is Lyle Troxnell, and we'll go ahead and go on with the Geek News. Miles, I think I'll start with you.
As I am not ready.
Okay, Ben, go for it.
All right. So President-elect Barack Obama had his official portrait captured, and it was the first time the presidential portrait was captured on a digital camera, which means we have metadata about when that picture was taken, at what focal length, aperture, exposure, everything. That's just really cool. Like, metadata is really neat, but, you know, when you get something as high profile as, like, the presidential, you know, picture, that's just really cool.
Including what kind of camera it was.
Exactly, yeah. It's
like what kind of camera was it?
It's a 5D Mark II.
Yeah.
And they used Photoshop CS3.
Do you get to put that on your belt notch?
No? We sent up a copy of CS4 because we figured we don't want them falling behind the times.
Was the photographer a well-known photographer that did that?
His name's Souza is his last name, and I think mm-hmm. he's been following him for quite a while now.
Yeah, Pete Souza. He's the newly announced official White House photographer.
Oh, very cool.
That's a cool job.
I would assume. All right, so have some metadata about the president. That's cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
That's simple news. But
is the raw file being released?
I haven't seen it, but maybe it's around. But all of the metadata is listed right here in front of me.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. January 13th.
What was the lens set to?
At 5:38 p.m. is exactly when it was taken.
Was it an 80mm lens?
It was 105mm focal length. Okay. ISO 100, aperture of 10.
So is the shot down to the waist?
1/25th. Yeah, it's okay. Down to like the, I don't know, halfway down his tie.
All right. Let's go on to the next news story. Miles, you ready now?
Yes, I am.
You just look it up. It's on the GeekSpeak site, or it will be soon.
YouTube has been pulling the plug, at least with regard to audio, on movies that have been uploaded that have what have been seen as being copyrighted content. So copyright infringement, anyone who puts up a video or puts up a video that has some background music, especially from the Warner Music Group, YouTube, instead of just pulling down the video altogether, they have now been simply taking away the audio track and making it silent.
Because that's normal, the infringement is audio.
It's normally the infringement.
Yeah.
But it also acts as a nice halfway point to say, like, hey, there's something wrong, because most people don't want to have it there. They'll take the video down or re-upload it with, you know, some other audio track, or, you know, make their own music, you know, play chopsticks on the piano or something like that. But what has been interesting about it, though, is that Warner and other music entities have been putting in these Digital Millennium Copyright Act takedown notices.
Yeah.
But there hasn't been a big follow-through with YouTube in terms of aggressiveness towards solving the problem, of actually checking to see whether it's fair use or not, whether or not someone is putting in an audio clip or the like, or a video clip that does fall under fair use provision, something that's a criticism of that, or show an example, or educational, or the like. And if you are now guilty, if you have 3 takedown notices applied against your account goes away, your videos are deleted. And this action takes place before you can actually respond to that and say, wait, no, this is in the safe harbor. And so now this is a big to-do. I expect to hear more about this.
Is that associated with the muting or not? It's not really associated with
me. This is just recent changes that have been made with regard to copyright works. Mm-hmm. Because Warner Music is fully justified to say, this is our music. People have their video and they decide to put our music on there to make their video seem more applicable. No.
Assuming that it doesn't fall into that fair use idea.
Right.
And, of course, they don't care about that fair use because they want to protect themselves as much as possible. So they're going to take down the new takedown.
It seems like the takedown is the iron fist, audio takedown is the velvet glove.
If I went on air and started making social commentary about news events and in those stories using clips of Warner Brothers, for example, then I was making social commentary about those things, which would be a fair use, pretty clear fair use case. Mm-hmm. They would be kind of looking at my account. They'd give me a couple takedowns, and the third one, YouTube would ban me. Even though there was really no reason from a legal perspective.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that update on muting YouTube.
Thank you for summing it up so much better than I could.
Whatever. Let's go on to Alan. Go for it.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that are kind of exciting to me, but I think one thing that I saw the other day that goes on an iPhone, it's a completely non-powered amplifier that looks like a Victrola. It's just a big horn that you stick in the iPhone in the top, and literally you wouldn't think it would work. It just looks really it's kind of big, but I was with my friend and we went to use the speakerphone, and he stuck the iPhone in there, and man, we were just talking, and it sounded kind of like you were talking, talking a little bit like this all the time, but you know, it was really a neat thing that had used absolutely no power, you know, and it just kind of shows you that everything is, you know.
It's very common when if you're using an iPhone, you're watching video or YouTube or something, you've got like 3 people around you,
right.
You hold your hand in a way that cups the sound more to your faces, right? That's like the standard thing I do with my kids when I'm watching them. So it makes sense to go, well, let's build an apparatus that really plugs in. Does it kind of grab the bottom of the phone where the speaker is and kind of holds on to it?
It's got a little rubber foot. And you just stick it in there, and, you know, it's just, everything just, you know, keeps coming back, you know? It's this old Victrola kind of thing. And
you said you were using it on speakerphone. How well were the people on the other end able to hear you? Were they hearing also?
Yep. You know what? I don't think so, because he didn't even know, you know? He just, you know.
It would make sense, because really the speaker and the mic are right next to each other on the iPhone. They're right at the bottom, and this thing kind of clips onto the bottom of it. There's a picture of a
version. Right, I was just talking about if there's audio distortion coming from the speaker portion of it, then would there be distortion coming
into the mic? As opposed to when you don't do that, there's like no distortion.
Yeah. Well, if you do it without this cone, the speakerphone is merely quiet. It's almost too quiet to use, especially with the first generation iPhone.
Yeah.
So that's why I wonder about this, how much, because it has some utility, how useful is it?
Well, you know, it was useful for us, And I'm just excited that, you know, to see something, you know, the world revolves around little square boxes that you plug into things, and everything has a battery. And here, this thing comes out of nowhere. I think Griffin makes it, and you don't plug it in. You just right there. It's natural.
It's just using physics.
It's just using, you know, the things that we used in the 20s. You know, and there
it
is.
Thank you, Mr. Lacow, for the news story. Ben.
I've got two really quick people things. One thing I don't want to spend much time on, but Steve Jobs is taking a leave of absence from Apple for until June, according to his letter. So, you know, everyone's speculating about it, so maybe we shouldn't for once.
Sounds good. Moving on.
Moving on. And then also some sad news. A couple weeks ago, I covered a Star Trek death. Well, Ricardo Montalban is now dead, and that is very unfortunate. He was 88 years old, and he just died a couple days ago, January 15th. Best known for his role, playing the role of Khan in the original series Space Seed episode, as well as the movie that came after.
And Corinthian Leather, too. That, you can't.
Yeah. Oh, of course. Yeah.
I was going to say
maybe
Geek best known for.
Of course.
Don't forget, Boss, the plane.
It's me you're asking this question, right?
I know.
He just was in the movie business from when he was 21 until last year, 2008. Yeah. He was doing voiceovers, even though he was in a wheelchair. So pretty cool. Also, one quick related thing that I found on Boing Boing. Someone did a Google search for, any Star Trek fans out there, I'm going to alienate everyone else briefly, but so that quintessential moment of William Shatner's best acting moment when he goes, Khan, in Star Trek 2, someone did a Google search for Khan with different numbers of A's, mm-hmm. and actually plotted a graph of how many, you know, how many search results they got for all these different numbers of
What's
A's.
What's the winner?
Well, obviously the winner is one because Khan is everywhere, but it drops off steeply, and then there's another spike at 6, and then there's a spike at 41 and 47. So probably as far as the long ones, probably somewhere between 40 and 50. It's a pretty cool graph. It looks pretty random, but there's got to be some correlation between, you know, how many times or how long people hold down their A key, you know, and with their emotional state at the time or whatever. I don't know.
That does sound pretty random.
I'd love to do a dissertation. Oh, I'm sure there's no statistically significant, you know, yada yada. But anyway,
I'm losing my. I totally just forgot my job. But who's next on the news story? Is it you, Miles? Okay, go ahead.
So a couple weeks ago, talked about the fact that people haven't been updating their Windows, doing the Windows update, getting the patches. Someone had called in asking about, is this actually true? I mean, are Trojans really an issue? Is this something we really need to worry about, or is this something that just happens out there? Well, there is a bug out there that's called the down addup worm that is found to have been infecting, and at one point it infected 1.1 million PCs in a single day, and its infection rate is still going on. As it turns out, it's exploiting a bug that was fixed by Microsoft back in October.
Why haven't people updated?
See, there's the big question. One, I'm thinking some home users just don't know how important it is, and it is very important, and there is something in the wild, so if you haven't updated yet, please do it now. But it turns out that corporations are becoming a major issue. A lot of them are being very conservative with regard to their patch rollouts because sometimes when you roll out a patch, it breaks things.
Right.
So you go through a testing process, and Microsoft has their patch Tuesdays, and so you get this whole patch set, you try it on your systems, you test it against there, and you fall behind. And you basically say, well, if this doesn't affect us, doesn't seem like it's a big problem, we're not going to do it.
Well, it's one of those things that's risk analysis. If you're going to take out your entire business for a day because of some patch problem, or there's a vector, but maybe no one's taking an exploit of it, so you're not going to get affected, you kind of look at that and go, well, it's a higher probability that if there are people look at it and go, it's a higher probability that we'll actually mess ourselves up from trying to patch too quickly, I can see where they'd be in that situation. But as soon as a worm hits like this, how damaging is this worm?
So far, it's a command and control style. Mm-hmm. So in other words, being able to orchestrate some denial, a distributed denial of service attack. Right. I don't see any actual...
No data loss, no. Yeah.
Not that I can see. At the same time, once you have something like that on your system...
You don't know what's coming next.
Right. You don't know what's going and coming.
Yeah. Okay, well, the big lesson is update your Microsoft system. Really easy to do. Start button at the top, Microsoft update. Do it regularly, once a week.
Actually, turn on the automatic updates.
That's right. And how do you do that? Under control panel?
Chances are when you have a new XP or Vista install, it will actually prompt you for that to say...
But right now, I don't know if I've updated and I do the update and I see that a lot of updates happen, I want to auto-turn on. I would assume the control panel's on.
Yeah,
somewhere.
I don't know in Vista. XP was a control panel and you had security settings.
All right.
But.
So it might be under security settings.
Auto-update's the best way to go because then you don't have to remember.
Yeah. And you can do auto-update with prompting. The other thing, of course, with that is that sometimes if you do auto-update, it's going to actually do it when you shut the machine down. So there'll be a time when the machine says shutting down, working on updates. Just let it do its thing. And then, of course, call us when it actually doesn't do its thing. Let's go on. Alan.
I think I should mention that Mars is passing gas. Apparently, they've found methane on Mars, which, shows evidence of life, So I think...
It's organic compounds.
Organic, compounds. I'm well aware of this, this passing gas thing. I think we all are, and it's something we should all think about because...
Would the methane be coming from?
It's coming from underground. Somewhere underground, they have microscopic things on Mars, and it means there might be life up there.
So is it possible that the methane is being created in some other fashion rather than life?
There is a geological method.
Okay. So it's an unknown, but it's kind of exciting.
It's coming from the area that they say there's ancient groundwater, ice underneath. So
there's a probability.
May have some life up there.
That's pretty cool.
Yep.
Methane.
Mm-hmm. Celebrate the release of gas.
It always scares me. I remember at one point someone said, if people get into going to Mars and corporations will do it and they'll start mining oil on Mars. I'm like, well, if there's oil on Mars, that's going to be pretty amazing because that will show life. And now I'm kind of scared that we'll find life sources other places because, of course, it's such a compelling thing to do for a corporation. But in any case, methane on Mars, very cool.
Yes, methane on Mars. So what's next, Lyle?
Who is next? Let's see. I think it's Ben.
I think I'm next. Okay, I just want to cover this briefly because I forgot to cover it last week, and I find it really interesting. According to this article, these are their words, some hippies in England are concerned over this new Wi-Fi network that's been implemented, this free Wi-Fi network, kind of like what Google was doing in Mountain View. Mm-hmm. So my question to Lyle is, could Wi-Fi lead to a loss of creativity or other such health ailments? Because this
only
is what they're
claiming. Only if you spend a lot of time using Wi-Fi on your computer and you're doing things that cause you not to be creative, like playing video games that don't have a lot of creativity.
Okay.
But no.
That's pretty much it.
I think that Wi-Fi has no effect on humans.
Yeah, apparently residents of this... Glastonbury.
When I saw that this news story didn't go up last week because you didn't cover it, I was really like, yeah, cool.
it's so funny to me,
though. We get people complaining about Wi-Fi all the time.
We have so much EM radiation constantly going through our bodies. So, like, Wi-Fi is nothing. We've got cell phones. We've got, even other people's cell phones, right? You have a cell phone. How many people around you have cell phones?
There are a lot of other people. There are a lot of other things in the world.
It can cause a lot of injuries, Wi-Fi. I mean, when you're driving around looking for a Wi-Fi spot.
That's true.
And your laptop is on your car seat, and you're looking for that
little... Which is illegal, by the way.
Which I've heard people do. You could really get injured that way.
So, as a point of reference, just because a lot of people need a point of reference, if you have a TV and you turn onto a channel that isn't being broadcast in a particular area and you see that white snow, that is not the absence of a signal. That is, in fact, the signal, the background that we get from space.
Where you're going with this.
No, it's the background that you get from space. That is what's there all the time. This is the same thing with Wi-Fi. We are getting... frequencies from all over the band at all times.
The universe, not just human-made.
Right, but at the same
time... Yeah, it's free Wi-Fi implemented by, what are those Scientology aliens, the Zard something?
Right, so now it comes the question of how much more is Wi-Fi adding? And Wi-Fi is adding so little to it. The fact that these Wi-Fi transmitters and receivers can send and receive at such low voltage, such low power ratings, is astounding to me. Mm-hmm. But what's more astounding is that could actually cause a problem, considering all the background.
So I know why people are having problems with this in this town. It's this thing called the placebo effect, right?
Sure, I'll go with that. We're moving on.
Yeah.
The geeks today are Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, and Alan Luckow. My name's Lyle Troxell. We now are joined by, the entire time we've been joined by, just kind of mysteriously, by Brian Hughes. Brian Hughes is a product manager on the Photoshop team and a product evangelist for Lightroom. And Brian has spent the last 10 years helping to test, drive, develop, and demonstrate Adobe's professional imaging products. You're also a photographer, though you don't show it very often.
That's right.
Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
So, Brian, you actually also happen to be local, which is always nice to have a local come on.
And I am. That's the best thing about it, is just driving right down the road.
Did you hear about us on air? Did you just listen to us?
So I do. I do listen, and I was in a meeting the other day talking about how I'd been traveling all over and doing this press stuff, and my boss said, when are you going to get on GeekSpeak? They're right down the road from you.
Oh, cool.
And I said, God, that's a great question. I'll ask him. And
great.
Here I am.
Well, thanks for coming on. So Photoshop CS4 has a few new features. I'm still on Photoshop CS3, and I want to start off by kind of talking a bit about the upgradation path. You guys released 4 about a year and a half after CS3, right?
Roughly, yeah.
And there are some definitely new features, some graphics acceleration, which makes the application a lot faster if you've got a newer graphics card, which is really, very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
And some cool stuff with being able to manipulate photos automatically that allow you to rescale a photo.
Yeah.
What's that feature called?
Content-aware scaling, previously known as seam carving.
Okay. So we'll get into some of that a little bit, but I want to talk about the price and the upgrade path and is it totally viable to justify a repurchase? And I don't know. It just seems to be, I don't want to fork out the dough for Photoshop again. That's my first stance. They released a new product. Do I have to get it?
Because it's been 18 months, right, since CS3?
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on that? I know that you don't
absolutely
necessarily set price
or anything. Certainly different answers for different people. Photoshop wears a lot of different hats. After 18 years, there's so many different people that use Photoshop for so many different things. And I think CS3, for all the folks who were, Intel, on Mac, that was a huge reason right there.
Right,
but
right.
Then it's what's the reason for people who are on CS4?
What you're talking about is that Apple moved over to Intel processors, but CS2 was still running on a Macintosh in the G4 space, so when you ran it in Intel, it was a lot slower than even running it on your older hardware.
That's
and
right.
So CS3 said new to Intel, and it was actually very hard. I have a tester that works at Adobe. That project was very hard to get into. It took a lot of resources to get Adobe to move to Intel for the Mac.
Mm.
So in any case, that was a big reason. That's why I did do CS3. Al, was that why you did it too?
Yeah. That's why I went to CS3.
Yeah.
And the CS3, that commitment was serious. It was the same kind of upgrade path. And I thought, they finally came out with this great thing. I'm going to fork out all this, $1,000 and just update everything, get the designer suite and everything. And then 18 months later, hey, why don't you do it again? And a lot of people are thinking that,
Right. So there is a ton there. There's absolutely a lot of stuff there. There are a lot of problems that have been solved that we've been vexed with for a long time. You were talking about the GPU and tapping into that. It turns out, and the video game companies have known this forever, that there's a tremendous amount of power sitting on board every computer there, and we've really tapped into that. The other thing that I say that we focus a lot on is usability. After 18 years, we don't get rid of a lot of things, you can tell when you use the app.
There's a lot of features.
Right. So we're really trying to advocate the best way of doing things and help people find that best way, but to the people who have been using it, make it faster and more powerful. And then there are things like you talked about with content-aware scaling that's just magic, things that you couldn't do before. Mm-hmm. 3D, content-aware scaling, all sorts of things like that. So there is a tremendous amount in there. There's actually more in CS4 than there was in CS3.
Of changes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let me ask you this then. For a long time, there's Photoshop Elements was kind of a... I wouldn't even say it's really the same application in any way, but it does. It's by Adobe and it manages photos. But what's the thought process on Photoshop? Where do you cut down different markets and say, this is actually a home person? Al is professional.
you know, does work with professionally. So him putting down that kind of money makes sense. Me, mostly what I do this for is doing photo family, you know, shots. Mm-hmm. I can't justify an expense like that. It's just not going to happen. So why, you know, are you losing a larger market? And what's your thought on that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, long ago, it used to be pretty simple. When I started on the Photoshop team almost 10 years ago, there was Photoshop. There was Photoshop LE for a little while, but that went away. Photoshop Elements came along a little while later, and the whole idea was more consumer-focused and to just make things a lot easier to use, because Photoshop itself has always been a professional imaging solution and a platform in that it reads so many different sorts of file formats. But then along comes Album and Photoshop Lightroom, which you and I were talking about earlier, Photoshop.com. So that name appears in a lot of different places. And the reason for that is there are a lot of different people who have digital imaging as part of their workflow and need different solutions that scale to their aptitude and their needs. But for the most part, what I talk about and you know, what we're talking about is Photoshop CS4 or Photoshop CS4 Extended, both of which are
the gold the deeper standard. Color space. Mm-hmm. Okay, so one thing that kind of ties into this is the only reason I know Photoshop and the reason why when I go to a company and I work for website development and all that, I say Photoshop is because the first few years of Photoshop, I stole it. I just took copies from other people and used it. So I got my proficiency up. I think a lot of people do that. And so my feeling is that you've got a large, successful install base of people that know how to use this, even though they don't necessarily know how to, you know, make a lot of money on it. Mm. And that's, in some ways, what's made you this very dominant space. Of course, also that there's not a lot of alternatives out there that have the same kind of level of saturation, if you will. But I think that saturation is based upon people hacking it for a long time. You guys have tied down that a lot now. It's very hard to crack the application
although,
at this point.
Although I think it's very fair. I mean, I think Illustrator as well was one of those programs that everybody hacked, Illustrator 88. Everybody had it. They used it. They could do anything they wanted with it. But now with your activation, you allow it on two machines. You know, I have, you know, quite a few machines, and if I take my laptop, I can deactivate one and activate. I think it's completely fair. I mean, I haven't really seen this with too many programs, and one thing I should say is that was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, just to touch on that, I mean, there are a lot of different ways to get to the app. There is a very nice upgrade path, and it goes back several versions. There are times when we flat out give it away. When we think back to CS3, we did a public beta of Photoshop, which at the time was completely unheard of, so that all of those people who are waiting for that Intel version could get right on
That's
it.
Right.
So there's that penalty the first time, and then from then on, it's a lot easier to get into the app.
Mm. All right, we're listening to Geek Speak. You're listening to Geek Speak, and I'm talking with the geeks here. The geeks today are Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, Al Luckow. My name is Lyle Troxell. We are speaking with product manager on the Photoshop team, Brian Hughes. We're taking calls with questions and comments about Photoshop. That's what we're going to be sticking with today, or in general image manipulation stuff. Join us Tuesday for coverage of the... Oh, and I'll give out the phone numbers in just a second. Join us Tuesday for coverage of the Obama inauguration. Starting with Morning Edition, NPR will carry you along with the crowds on Washington, D.C.'s streets and the National Mall between the Capitol Building and the Washington Monument. The anticipation, the preparations, the expectations, and the people are all over the nation who are gathering Washington for this inaugural event. NPR will be there, and you can be there too, of course, radially, virtually. Tuesday from 3 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. here on Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. Geek Speak on KOSP is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. Okay, here are the phone numbers to call us up about photo manipulation and Photoshop questions and comments. The phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. Or if you're outside the 831 area code, call us toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. The geeks again today, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe, Alan Luckow. My name's Lyle Troxell. We're speaking with Brian O'Neill Hughes. He's product manager for Photoshop, and you're welcome to call us with questions about the topic. Again, the phone number is 476-2800. Again, 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. That's 1-800-655-KUSP. So tell us what this magic stitching thing is, this rescaling thing.
Right. So content-aware scaling, it's certainly one of those things that's best shown, and I'll let everybody know that you could go to seamcarving.com or you could go to my recent Mac session. But essentially what it does is it looks at an image and it says, well, maybe you want to make that smaller, but you don't want to lose important parts of your image. I've got a friend standing on the left side of the frame and another friend standing on the right. I want to bring them together, but I don't want them getting cropped out. So you select it and you go into this new feature called content-aware scaling, and it sort of magically carves the image up and blends it and uses all sorts of sophisticated technology we've had for a while to make sure that you can't even really tell what's gone. And,
so I'm assuming this is working off like contrast patterning and the idea of like a vertical line. If you're doing vertical squishing, you can shrink that a bit. But it seems to, I mean, it does, when you say magic, that kind of brings up a geek thing in me going, sure. Explain it. Don't say
yeah,
magic.
Definitely.
It's not magic.
Unless it's actual magic.
unless we actually magic, have a genie.
It's just magic. Yeah, we just pull it out of the hat.
So what it's, I guess, a lot of complicated algorithms, right? I
mean, yeah, absolutely. And it's mapping frequency. It's not just a straight line. It's looking at the image. It's set so that it knows what organic subject matter is. It tries to protect against lines. It knows what people look like. You can actually click on a little icon in the toolbar, which I refer to as the men's room sign because it looks like a little outline of a guy.
Person.
And that'll protect for skin tones. But the really neat thing that you can do, and this being Photoshop, you see the men's room sign.
It does look like a men's room sign.
The really neat thing that you can do is that you can make a selection and you can choose to preserve that particular part. Or if you really want to get tricky, you could invert the selection so that as soon as you start shrinking your image, you dismiss that part of it from it. So you can use it as a tourist.
So this is radio. I'm going to try to do an image of this. So imagine you have a golf course. And on the golf course is a golf cart in the center of the screen and only takes up 10% of the screen, so it's kind of small. But you've got a whole bunch of green, a whole bunch of trees in the background and some houses and stuff. And what it's going to do is kind of, it recognizes the rectangular shape of the house and it recognizes the golf cart and it recognizes that a tree has its form. And so when it shrinks it, it doesn't really touch those things. It touches all the grass and kind of just sucks up the grass.
That's
so it really is looks like that magic. All of a sudden the houses all get tighter, the trees get tighter, the golf course is, takes up more of the percentage of the screen. It's pretty impressive tech.
Thank you. You can even use it to expand the image. You can make the image larger than it originally was and introduce grass and yeah. trees and sky and clouds.
Last night I was at a little dinner cocktail party kind of thing and ran into two wedding photographers. They're a husband-wife team. They switch off both doing it. And they shoot a lot of RAW and they use Lightroom 2 as their path. And when talking with them, I said, what I think would be great for you guys is making like albums. When you see the wedding albums, right? The idea of you need a long shot here, and really you have a shot that's a little not as long, so you can widen it out. And it's that small manipulation I think would be most convenient for. Because the truth is, like, what that does, I can do in Photoshop. It would take me a long time to do it, right? But now it's just a slider. So the small manipulation. The other thing you mentioned is just matching print sizes.
Right. That's always driven me crazy that, 8x12 is full frame, 5x8 is full frame, 11x17 is full frame. But the frame sizes are 5x7 and 8x10 and 11x14. And you're always getting punished for making enlargements. So if you're going to do that now, at least you don't have to lose the important parts of your image.
Right. Now, of course, it's very destructive, right?
It is very extremely. We always talk about non-destructive and re-editable, and we do a lot of great things around those. But this is, by nature, a very destructive process, yeah.
Right. Ben, you've been playing with Photoshop CS4 for a little while before we start taking calls. What besides that feature, what else are you liking or disliking?
Gosh, you caught me out of bed.
Oh, really?
Actually, I have a question with regard to the stretching. With regard to that stretching, you say it's destructive as you stretch out. What happens if you're playing with it and you stretch it out and then you bring it back to its original position? Does it remember that original position?
It does, yeah. It does a really nice job of pulling it back in because it'll look at it in the same way that it did the first time.
So the end result is destructive, not necessarily while you're doing it.
As you're using the tool, it's non-committed.
Right, and I should clarify by saying that when I say destructive, I don't mean that it'll look great. It's just the re-editability is affected.
It's like what we tell people, if you edit a photo, don't then save it as a JPEG, because every time you do that, you lose information. And in a computer sense, we call that destructive.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely.
I think we'll go ahead and take a call from Charlie. Line one, Miles. Charlie, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. Hey there.
Hi. What's the question?
Okay. So this is Charlie from Dr. Don. Mm-hmm. And I have one major, major problem with Adobe in their upgrade path.
Okay.
The one person they did not think of is the person who, before these big suites came out,
yes,
had practically everything, and now you want to convert over to a suite. See, and so like I've spent thousands of dollars over the year, I mean, buying legal copies of Photoshop, Premiere, After Effects, Illustrator, And then when it came to buying, you know, to switching over to the suite, it was like, you know, $1,000. There was basically a discount if you had any one of these products, but there was no discount if I had five of them.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I have complained and complained over the years about that. And it's gotten just slightly better with the last round. And so I actually finally did make the jump. And I went I talked him down $100. So instead of like $1,000, there was like $900 to get the. It's a suite that includes Premiere and it has the movie stuff.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of advantages. You know, once you are in the suite, but to your point, getting there. You know, that's
getting there was really hard.
So,
you know.
So what about so that was a CS3, right, Charlie?
So I'm in CS3 now, and then and I just did that last fall, and now there's CS4.
Yeah.
And yep. CS4 is a pretty big chunk, even from CS3 to CS4.
Yeah, but you're always penalized, often monetarily, for being at the latest and greatest of hardware, software, you know, whatever.
Oh, no. Everybody accuses me of that, but it's not true.
Oh, I'm not accusing you of anything.
I think you meant in the general sense. Charlie, thanks for the call.
Right, so that's
Thank
it.
You.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Charlie's the producer of Dr. Dawn, which comes on right before us. And, you know, if you don't listen to their KOSP podcasts and such, please do. There's some great shows here. And the other thing, speaking of shows on KOSP, I just got to mention, the 7th Avenue Project with Robert Pauly is such a good show. It's on Sundays in the afternoon, and I know it sounds kind of commercial, but that's my own personal opinion. The views expressed on Geek Speaker are not necessarily those of KOSP. In any case, that podcast now, just what a great show. Anyway, let's go on line two. In Marina, Jeff, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, geeks.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Yeah. So I have a question about the features of CS4.
Yes.
I have a upgrade box sitting on my desk, and I haven't opened the blister pack yet or the wrapping because I'm not too sure I actually want to go there.
Oh, you do. You do.
Yeah. Well, I have a critical application that I'm looking for a solution. I have promised to make a 4K movie.
Mm.
And that is a super high definition, you know, 4,000 by 2,000 pixels. And one of the way to do it, because the video cameras that do this are insanely expensive, you know, the cheapest one is $50,000,
mm-hmm.
Is to use kind of a high-end digital SLR and
okay.
take a time-lapse.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
But you want to be able to then process the images kind of in a batch mode and send them to a video editing program. And I'm a Mac user, so of course I'm on Final Cut Pro. I did use Premiere years ago.
Wait, slow down. Hang on a second, Jeff. I got to ask. When you say high-end SLR, are you talking about keeping the shutter open and trying to grab the files from it through?
No, I'm talking about setting up a camera and taking a series of photographs over, let's say, 12 to 24 hours. Maximum shutter, you know,
gotcha.
Maximum pictures would be about 4 per second.
Okay.
And then
but during low-light
video.
Situations, it's going to be longer exposures.
Uh-huh. So you wouldn't be doing real-time kind of video?
I'm sorry?
It wouldn't be a real-time video. You're not going to have an actor there going in slow motion trying to speak. And
yeah, because while I understand that you can take short clips of real-time video at resolution with these cameras. Yeah.
Okay, so I got what you're doing.
I'm going to do a time-lapse.
You're only going to be doing time-lapse and making that into a movie. Okay,
right.
So go on. You were saying what tool
you were using? So what I really want is some kind of round trip from the photo editing to a video editing suite where I can, you know, each picture gets put in at 1/30th of a second to equal
right.
a frame of video.
Right.
I want to be able to do my edits, you know, apply things like crossfades and finally do color correction inside of my video editing suite, and then send it back to the image processing software such as CS4,
mm-hmm.
and then output it as uncompressed TIFFs.
Right. So I can tell you there's so much there. There are a lot of very specific video applications that would solve that in different ways. But I will tell you one thing that you might not know, which is that as of CS3 Extended, which is our foray into sort of more deeper niche markets like film, right, video, 3D, you can send your frames over to Photoshop as individual stills. You can do that from Lightroom or Bridge. And you can make a time-lapse video because that extended release does support video output. So when it comes to the time-lapse image, you could do that there. Now, with the image editing, if you chose to do the video somewhere else, you could certainly automate any sort of color correction or standardization that you wanted to apply to all of those images. So you could either choose to use multiple applications working together, or it sounds like in this case you could actually do quite a fair amount of that in Photoshop.
But is the Photoshop?
And I may be able to generate the proxy movies that I want to use for editing in Photoshop and then take them over to Final Cut. The last little bit of technical hurdle here is that they're going out to a 4K projector. And 4K projectors really just play a temporal series of TIFFs, uncompressed raw images, in as fast as it can go, in 30 frames per second. So ultimately,
How does it get the source?
I'm sorry?
How does the projector get the source for 4K?
You have to have a special appliance. Uh-huh. And it's basically
so there's a codec that goes with the camera, or with the projector.
It doesn't. There's only a few cameras in the world that can stream live video at that frame rate. So you basically, it's a file-based approach, and you load all of your pictures in folders, and your folder equals your movie. And then when you hit play on this appliance, it sends 4 DVI signals that are standard, you know, HD signals. And the projector composites them and projects them as one image. It's really rather stunning. But I said, unless you have big bucks for a video camera, it's difficult to create content.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like, Brian, it sounds like your recommendation would be to get the extended version of Photoshop that can do more of these features.
You're certainly going to want some semblance of video in Photoshop no matter what here, and that would allow you to both import and export that. Of course, Bridge can allow you to preview that video once you've pushed it out. Right. But I think the other thing that I would say here, and I'm not certain if you got an upgrade to the Point product or to the Suite, but you know, we talked earlier about, you know, why we iterate so quickly. Part of the reason is, if we look back just a couple years, we acquired Macromedia not too long ago, and making certain that all of those applications in the Suite speak to each other is a huge feature in and of itself. And so a lot of what you see in CS4 is the applications working with each other in a way that they hadn't before. So your solution might be...
And that's really the power of these creative suites, is you can move very easily from one application to another.
Jeff, do you...
I didn't consider the value of installing Photoshop to generate the proxy movies from which I can edit. Mm. I'm interested then if there's any XML ingest in Photoshop CS4 Extended that lets you apply any edits that you might have done, say, in Premiere.
There's a tremendous amount of power there. There's a tremendous amount that can be done around the information that sits alongside your files. So I would certainly encourage you to investigate that a bit more.
Is that box in front of you?
Actually, the title of my talk is Creating 4K Content on a Budget. And while some people might say, oh, my gosh, I can't spend that kind of money on a software program, it really is a great solution if you really want to make this high-end content and you don't have the money to buy a camera.
All right, Lyle, what were
you saying? Thank you. I was just going to ask if the box that you have is the extended version of Photoshop.
I believe it is, yeah.
Okay, good. So you could probably move forward. And thank you very much, Jeff, for the call.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks, geeks.
Let's go ahead and go to Hollister. Matt, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Matt. I just got Lightroom, and living in Hollister, there are no courses or anything I can take. I'm interested in text. It would help me, or learning systems. I have looked at Adobe Photoshop. I am technically savvy. Adobe TV.
Yeah.
And other online stuff. There's a lot of good stuff there, but I was wondering about a text.
Yeah, you got it. So I take it you're a photographer of sorts?
Yes, I'm an enthusiast.
Okay, so my friend Martin Evening wrote a fantastic book called Lightroom for Photographers. I highly recommend that. It's a wonderful resource. It really covers all sorts of different things. We've got a lot of resources on our site, but it sounds like if you want a book, I think Martin's would be a great way to go.
Which one is that?
Lightroom for Photographers.
Martin Evening does Lightroom for Photographers. The one other one that I always recommend is Scott Kelby's book on Lightroom as well. They're both fantastic. You could find either one of them at Amazon or any of your local bookstores.
Yeah, I got a book recently from O'Reilly called Photoshop Lightroom 2 Adventure, which is a good book.
That's
is that
a great
Scott's
one too.
Book or is that different?
That's a different book. There are, I think, 11 Lightroom books out right now. I've probably flipped through half of them, and they're all wonderful. I mean, it's meant to be fairly approachable software, but that's not to say that there aren't a lot of things to learn. So I definitely encourage you to do that.
Now, Scott, who was it?
Scott Kelby and Martin Evening are the two sources. If you're interested in black and white, this is an opportunity to shamelessly promote my own book on a black and white workflow using Photoshop and Lightroom. But there's a lot out there, and I think those two guys, Martin Evening and Scott Kelby, do a great job with those.
Beautiful.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, so we've been talking about Photoshop, and I think we might have another call, but let's wait just a second to do another round of Ben. I think I asked you earlier, and we went off to a news story, what else are you finding interesting or dislikable about Photoshop CS4?
There are three other things that I really like. 3D, you can make panoramas, you can manipulate 2D.
Can you actually save to QuickTime VR?
You can with the spherical panoramas, no. So you're used to sort of a QTVR thing.
Yeah.
Now, you can export video as a QuickTime movie or as a Flash video. So perhaps there's some work around there.
It's so hard to get to QuickTime VR, and it's one of those things I want to do all the time.
Right.
How do you do QuickTime VR?
I've done it usually still scenes, and it's always something seamed together or a product that you're flipping around.
But you could think of this as something very similar to that. A spherical panorama is the ability to sort of spin around in this virtual world. And
right,
you
but I want to be able to put it online so that people can see it, and that's why
so
you need
Flash,
QuickTime VR.
Flash video.
Yeah, Flash.
FLV.
Oh, so you output to Flash?
Yeah.
Oh,
if you've got Flash installed, you can export to an FLV and post that to the web.
And that would be a panorama that was
interactive.
Manageable? Interactive panel? Thank you.
Yeah, so there it gets a little muddy.
Okay. More of a video kind of thing.
Kind of like Google Street View.
That's cool, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, that one's interactive, but it
sounds
like
the interactive experience with this is in the application. You actually need that in a player, which, of course, is where QTV comes
in. Which you might
build
in. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that was one.
The second is GPU acceleration.
Sure.
And a large part of that is being able to rotate the canvas. So
all the
like,
cool new features that come with it.
Yeah, especially if you have, like, I have one of the MacBook Pros that supports the pinching and rotation on the trackpad, and you can just kind of throw around your canvas like that.
Yeah. Have you been able to rotate the canvas before? We're talking about not actually changing the image rules, but changing how the image is displayed on the screen at one time.
Like
so when you rotate the rulers of the application still follow along with the same pixel count and all that.
That's right. This is just rotating the view. It's just changing how you see it. And the thing that I always say is, it's as if I handed someone a piece of paper and asked them to sign their name, first thing they do is turn the paper. We all do it. It's more ergonomic. A lot of people obviously use tablets. And so we wanted to get it to the point where you could rotate the canvas as you do in some other illustration programs. But that's been a limitation of how we show the data on screen because it would appear choppy. If you looked at an image in the past at 33 or 66%, wouldn't look quite right. Same reason, but because we're pushing it through the GPU, it works very well now.
That. Okay, so you weren't able to change it like that before?
No.
Because that's exactly one of the in a lot of art applications, you can rotate the canvas like that.
That's
when you're using a tablet and you want to paint, Photoshop's been a little difficult in that.
That's
area.
Right.
You have a lot
you
of people.
Do some of the loose drawing in something else and then import it in Photoshop. So that's a good feature.
You have
see.
A lot of people turning their heads to one side to try to, or
leaning your laptop up on one side.
Yeah.
So there you have it. We're helping out with repetitive stress right there.
There's got to be some laptop stand out there that like turns your laptop or your monitor screen so you can turn your tablet.
Of course, you can get the really expensive Wacom tablet that actually has a screen in it, and then
as you move it,
it does whatever you want. That's, of course, what everybody wants. Alan, do you have one of those?
No. You could also get a Modbook.
That's right.
That's true.
Got one of those here in my bag.
Do you have a Modbook?
I do. I was helping those guys out at Macworld. Yeah.
Oh, so you saw then? Well, Alan did the presentation with Woz.
Yeah.
So the single weirdest experience and most wonderful experience of Macworld for me was being up on stage in Axiatron's theater and feeling like I was doing four sessions and it was my second session and suddenly the whole show descends upon the theater and I thought, oh, wow, I'm really hitting my stride here. And I walk off stage to hand the microphone to the next guy and the next guy is Woz and I figure, that explains it. That's what happened.
It wasn't you being amazing.
It's possible that was
Let's take one more call, and Ben, you got one more item.
Oh, yeah, one more thing is just the adjustment in the masks panel. which is really neat. You don't like when you're changing the curves, you don't have to do it within a window. Like your Photoshop doesn't become inactive when you're doing that. So that's pretty cool.
All right. Well, actually, Miles tells us, but we don't have any more calls, so I guess we lost Mary at Boulder Creek. In any case, you're welcome to ask us questions all week long on our forums, forums.geekspeak.org. And if you have questions to our guests, we'll redirect to them. So, you know,
I'm easy to find.
Brian's local. You can catch him on Highway 9 sometimes. So definitely we're able to pester him at home and such.
That's a funny image in my head, someone like waiting on Highway 9.
That's him.
He drives this kind of car.
Brian, you actually also know a lot about Lightroom, and I'm assuming you use it for your own photography?
I do, quite a bit, yeah.
And your official title in that area is Evangelist. I want that. I want a title like that at some point.
Yeah, you know, it's scary everywhere but software. Software, it's a badge of honor, but, you know, outside of that, I tell my grandmother or something, and she shakes her head disapprovingly. But, yeah, it's evangelizing Lightroom is coming from a photographic background. It sort of comes naturally.
It's funny, Lyle, you say that you want to be an evangelist, and yet you do a radio show every week talking to folks about technology.
I'm trying to be impartial or evangelize the feeling of geekdom, whatever that is. I mean, so that's a little abstract. I know what I'm saying is I want a paycheck to come to me, and I want the reason for that because I believed in something really good.
Well, so it's all about greed. Okay, I see how it is.
If it helps, I don't collect a paycheck for the evangelism part. That
doesn't help
pro bono.
Next week we are going to be talking about Lightroom. Any more questions or comments about Photoshop CS4 for the geeks?
I'm kind of interested in that Flash palette you were talking about.
Yeah,
you can create
absolutely.
Your own palette in Photoshop of the tools that you want to use, and it's Flash-based.
That's
say.
Right. So, you know, Photoshop has the ability to host Flash panels now, which of course means that's web-aware. And there are a lot of benefits for developers and for users with that because you can reach out to the cloud. One of the great things, you know, Ben was asking me earlier, can I have shortcuts for this and that tool, or can I have just this limited tool set? Well, it turns out there's this really cool thing called the Configurator, which is a little app that allows you to cobble together your own UI and load that as a Flash panel. So I would definitely direct people towards our lab site, which is where all of our prototype early and free stuff is living there.
Yeah, no, so CS3 was the first time I really got focused on lab. Mm-hmm. And basically anything that you're not selling yet, but it's kind of an interesting feature and you want to show and share and beta and everything is at your labs. And that's when you release the beta version of CS3, which was one of those things that everybody could take it for a while and use it.
That's
it was
right.
Really nice. And what other stuff do you have in there, and how internally does stuff get to labs?
Yeah, so the lab site's wonderful. It's got, I mean, just thinking about CS4, it's got PixelBender, which is hardware-accelerated filtration. It's got the DNG profile editor, which as a photographer allows you to make your own DNG. You know, it's got things like the configurator. But sort of the background of it, it's one of those wonderful things that we inherited from the Macromedia acquisition, and they really had this great community sense of involvement. And so originally with digital imaging, Lightroom went up there in several different betas, several different free betas, so that our users could help us figure out what Lightroom was going to look like. So then when it came time to share Photoshop, we put it up there. There's a ton of stuff there. You just go to labs.adobe.com.
Yeah. Our guest today is Brian O'Neill Hughes. He lives in Ben Lomond. He's a product manager for Photoshop and knows a lot about Lightroom as well. Brian, I hope to have you on again.
I'd love to come back. It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. Thank the you. Geeks today, Ben Jaffe, Miles Elam, Alan Luckow. My name's Lyle Troxell. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arno, streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. Stay tuned for Car Talk. That's coming up next here on KOSP. Keep in mind that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence, and he's used by permission. And if you want to know who David Lawrence is, because I talk about him every week, he was just on some Heroes episodes. He played the Puppet Master. That's David Lawrence, who owns the GeekSpeak term and lets us use it for free. We thank him for doing that. My name's Lyle Troxell. You've been listening to KOSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak on KOSP with all the geeks. You can access us anytime you'd like by going to the forums and going to our website, geekspeak.org. If you're interested and have a show topic for us, please feel free to shout out to me and to us. We'd love to hear your input about the show. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for Car Talk.
In just a few seconds.
Two, one.